Welcome back to another episode of Everything Aviation Podcast. I want to thank you for your patience and I want to wish you a happy new year twice over. We didn't get any episodes out in 2023. Life was just really, really busy. But we are back and we have a fantastic guest to kick you off. Firstly, I just want to do a shout out to Warbird Coffee & Co. for keeping us caffeinated through all these episodes and keeping us going. They do fantastic coffee. And Airspare, who have been supporting me in my aviation flying. Go and check them out if you need any of your aviation needs. Next up, we have a fantastic guest, Laura Russell. Laura flies the Airbus for Aer Lingus. She was a cadet in 2016 and came up through their future pilot program. She's also a flight instructor and an aerobatic instructor. Laura also represented Ireland in the World Aerobatic Championships, making her the first female to ever do so in Las Vegas. Laura talks to us about being able to pull -7 and +7 G about G suits and what it's like to represent the country on a world stage. Laura, it is fantastic to have you on the show today. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
You've done a massive amount of array of stuff. Like, you've just looking at your Instagram, how you would introduce yourself. You've got Airbus driver, upside down pilot, flight instructor, physicist, web designer, a food monster. And I do believe you're the first Irish female to compete in a world aerobatic competition.
Yes, probably the food monster is the most important of those.
Well, I'd say that everyone in aviation, we always fly for that 100 euro hamburger.
Oh yeah, there's nothing like that, going somewhere to have a bit of food or having a picnic in the air is the best thing ever.
That's a good one as well. I always forget to move the mic boom though on the headset. So I have to eat the Snickers right now and smack it in and go. Oh.
Yeah. Most of my line training at work was exercises in how to eat gracefully while flying the Airbus.
That's the brilliant thing about the Airbus as well, is that it's got a tray rather than the Boeing where there's a yoke in the way.
Yeah, it's very civilized. We don't have to eat off our tech logs.
I love what this is like the most thing we're talking about with Airbuses and stuff. But
yeah.
I believe that there should be a journey to that tray, as do we say. How did you get into aviation?
Yeah, so it was definitely a bit of a scenic route for me. I started flying officially back in 2005, and it was just after my nan had bought me an intro flight for a half an hour in a Piper Cherokee up in Cork Airport in 2004. So I had just passed the leaving cert, the secondary school exams in Ireland, and I'd gotten a course in UCC to study physics. And just in celebration of that, she bought me a 30-minute flight in the Cherokee. So I took that flight in the winter of 2004 and like immediately just besotted with it, like just mesmerized. The whole thing was absolutely incredible to watch. And it was something I kind of came away from thinking, yeah, I want to be able to do this skill. Like, yeah. So I started taking lessons then in 2005, very slowly because I was obviously broke. I mean, I was a college student, so there wasn't a lot of pocket money to spare. So I ended up taking about, I guess it was probably 3 years in total until I got my PPL. So I did my PPL skill test when I was third year in UCC. So it would have been 2006.
Wow.
The winter of 2006, I got my PPL.
Brilliant. And how many hours did you do then between? Because I know, I think you only started flying commercially kind of recent enough.
Very recently. Yeah. I'm definitely still a baby commercial pilot. It took a long time. So I timed the learning to fly quite poorly in that when I finished my PPL, I still had another year of college to do. And the Celtic Tiger was just about to go kaboom. So I ended up essentially hour building for 10 years. And I didn't get the Aer Lingus cadetship, let's say, till 2016. But yeah, in the meantime, I'd been hour building and just trying to squirrel away savings. And just before I got the cadetship, I had basically completed the flight instructor course with Atlantic Flight Training in Cork. And obviously all the ATPL exams as well with that. And I think I probably went into the cadetship with about 300 hours in the flight instructor cert. So I felt like a bit of an oddball in there. But like, so the first half of the course was fine because it was all just single engine stuff again and the usual. And I didn't have to sit the ATPL exams again, thank goodness. But as soon as I got to the multi-engine and the instrument rating stuff, that was, crash into the learning curve. So yeah.
What was it like going from, because you said I didn't actually realize you'd gone into the cadetship with the instructor rating already in 300 hours. It gives a it gives a little bit of hope, because I've approached EasyJet and stuff like that and said, look, what do people want? And they're always a bit like, look, we don't want any more than kind of 70 to 100 hours. So it gives hope to people out there, and maybe people listen to this, that there is a chance that even if you do fly privately, that there's no much such thing as too many hours, as to say.
I mean, I can't speak for every airline, but certainly for Aer Lingus, like I think they're quite open to people having experience. However, that's with the caveat of, you can't have a CPL going into a cadetship. Obviously, you're definitely not 0 hours then. But as an example, in my cadet class, I mean, there was a couple of students who had 0 hours. I mean, they were fresh out of leaving cert, so 18 years old, with at most an introductory flight done. And then there was myself, like, who had kind of, taken the scenic route thus far. There was another couple of guys who were in Aer Lingus in other roles over the years and had a PPL or a handful of hours or, some sort of experience in single engine. But I think Aer Lingus definitely appreciate a wide spectrum of experience going into something like that. And it helps as well, I think, when you're sitting there in the interview in the cadetship, like, they want to know that you're eager, and how best to prove that other than, having gone off your own and making time and planning, your course and, making the effort to have taken some flying lessons to really figure out if you do enjoy the training and so on.
Yeah, and it's like an investment as well, isn't it? Because
It is.
it's people are like, oh, you put a lot of your hobby is so expensive. I don't see it like that. I just see it as an investment. And like you said, if Aer Lingus are happy
Completely.
with that, and you're sitting there and you're building your experience, and you're building, it's more a lifestyle, isn't it, than anything else. And you're going with them to say, look, I've pre-made this in a box. Here you go. What can you do with it?
Yeah, and definitely for me, like my experience in that application process, like I definitely had interview questions that were along the lines of, tell me about something that went wrong in an airplane for you. You know what I mean? I was able to answer that because I had, obviously in 10 years of flying, things will happen and you can talk about those experiences. And present yourself in the best light, obviously, in the interview. So, yeah, that's invaluable.
It's brilliant. Really, really cool. And was it weird when you, because you said it was a lot of single engine stuff, was it a bit weird that you were now, I suppose you were doing a bit of flying with instructors and stuff. Was it weird being an instructor yourself with all these hours, been flying with an instructor again?
It kind of, well, in one way, it wasn't because when you do that flying instructor course, you're sitting with a really experienced instructor anyway, and he's pretending to act the maggot beside you anyway. So there is a bit of, I suppose, there is a bit of a contrived situation or, scenario when you are doing that flight instructor course. And it felt a little bit like that at the beginning of the single engine stuff down in FTE when I was doing the cadetship. But to be honest, I actually just, like, I loved it. Like, it was great. It was good to review all the fundamentals. And they had some really nice methods for teaching navigation, which I took away with me personally for my own students, So it was all good. Yeah, it was great fun. And it was actually kind of like really nice to have to be doing a course that I knew I'd be all right at, like, I wasn't worried about passing or failing, like.
And then you mentioned that it was a bit of a what's the word I'm looking for? It was a bit different when you got to the multi-engine stuff. I think we spoke a little bit off air on it. Can you give us a rundown of what the multi-engine training for you looked like?
Yeah, so I had never flown multi-engine before I started the MEIR down in FTE. And luckily or unluckily, we had the Diamond 42s, like, which are absolutely beautiful machines and so modern. Like, we had an autopilot. I had never flown an autopilot before, so that to me was mind-blowing. Definitely, like, that part of the course, goodness, it really, really highlights any sort of reluctance to be self-disciplined, like, to approach things methodically and try not to be doing multitasking and doing everything at the same time as you're trying to level out the airplane and blah blah blah, So it's quite a good character building part of the course. I found it great fun. I would love to have done more of it actually, but it's short and sweet now in that ATPL course, or I guess MPL courses they're all doing nowadays.
I was going to say, the MPL course is a bit of a different one, isn't it? Because that's
It is,
mostly sim based, I think.
and like we were the last class to do the pure ATPL. The classes after us were all MPL, so their course was designed to create or to make them into the best possible multi-crew pilot possible. Whereas us, by the end of our ATPL course, we were like the best single pilot operator ever. You know, we were able to do absolutely everything, fly, radio, eat, navigate, whatever. But it's a bit different now. I think that that landscape has changed a little bit for commercial flying.
You see a lot now. I think EasyJet and a couple of other people are now pushing the MPL more than a full ATPL course, which is again great to see if that's the right direction you want to go.
It
But
is,
you've
and you
still.
know what? Like, even though I'm a traditionalist when it comes to flight training. Like, I think there's so much value to be gained from you going off solo, navigating around the country, making mistakes, and you know what I mean, and learning from them. And you don't get that in an MPL necessarily. However, if you know you're going on to commercial flying, then in the MPL makes absolute sense. You're going to be
Yes.
working in a multi-crew environment, and you should be trained as such, you know.
Yeah,
So yeah,
yeah.
I see both sides. Yeah.
And let's go back slightly. When did you then decide that? Because obviously there was, like we said, you've only recently taken up a position with Aer Lingus. So, at what point did you decide that you wanted to turn your PPL into a flight instructor's rating?
I think fairly early on, I kind of knew I liked teaching people. Like, I'd done a lot of it during my physics course in UCC. So that kind of clicked into place in my brain a few years after my degree. I suppose in my mind, I knew I had to do the ATPLs at some point, and then the flight instructor course, which, you know, both of those things were, you know, big wads of cash. So there was a bit of mental gymnastics in terms of how I would save and for them, and then go and do the courses and time it so that I wouldn't run out of my ATPL expiry time before doing the IOR, etc. All those little things that you have to be careful of before launching into the theory exams. So it was probably around 2011, 12 when I was like, oh, I really need to get cracking on this kind of soon, you know. I ended up after my degree in UCC, I did a PhD in physics, and that was great because I had a salary from that, so it allowed me to fly and build my hours and so on to actually get into the FI course, you know, to get all the requirements to begin the course. And after the PhD, I got like a regular person's job. I snuck into an engineering company in Galway in Ireland for a couple of years, and that really allowed me to save and properly start on the ATPLs, which I just did part time. But I knew, like, even, you know, they do like a pre-course assessment for the FIC for the flight instructor. Like, even from that, from day one, I was like, oh yeah, this is great. Like, I cannot wait to pass these skills on to someone, you know? Yeah, it's a very unique kind of satisfaction when you get to teach someone something in an airplane, you know? And extrapolating from that, like, teaching someone to fly straight and level upright is one thing, but teaching people to fly straight and level upside down is just a whole other level of exhilaration. It is just the best thing ever.
So let's stick with that for a second. Let's jump to that one. Is there, because obviously we'll touch on it again, but you are heavily into aerobatics and flying upside down. Like there's no such thing as an unusual, dangerous attitude for you, judging by your Instagram posts. Is there a separate course? Because obviously you have to go and build up aerobatics and stuff like that. So I'm fresh out of, say, the aerobatics course, but nowhere near would I be ready for an aerobatics instructor course. Is there a
Okay.
different instructor course that you would have to do, and how many hours would you need aerobatic wise to do it?
So to become an aerobatic instructor, it's a privilege you add to your instructor cert on your license. Technically, you just need to do an assessment of competence.
All right.
Yeah. However, I think what you'll probably find is that if you go and do that, it's quite a small community of aerobatic pilots in Ireland, England, and beyond, and everyone kind of knows each other. And we're quite a, I suppose, what would you call it? Like a self-moderating group of people, you know? So usually people get signed off when it's appropriate, when they're ready, if you like. Yeah, if that makes sense.
Which is probably the best way of doing it as well, rather than you just being able
Yeah.
to jump straight into it and been
teaching something
Yeah,
you
for sure.
haven't done, if that makes sense.
Yes. On the other hand, then you like there is now that it's mandated the UPRT,
Oh, yes.
and to become a UPRT instructor, there is a course, and that's quite well formalized and so on. And that's interesting because it does list explicitly the kind of stuff you need to demonstrate and run through on your training course in order to become a UPRT instructor. And in that, certainly, you need to be able to do all sorts of spins and recover from them, let's say, you know. Yeah, and that itself is quite a demanding handling course, if you like.
And how did you get into flying upside down, as to say? At what
Okay.
point of your PPL journey did you think, oh, I'm sick of going straight level. Let's flip this upside down or pass the 90-degree mark and see what happens.
This actually happened really early on, like this predated commercial flying or anything like that. In 2005, I went to the Saltfjall Air Show
All
in
right.
Galway. Yeah, first ever air show, and I had just done like a handful of hours in the Cherokee by then, and I was blown away. Like I'd never really seen aerobatics in real life before, or maybe maybe I had and I hadn't really taken any notice, but. For me, I suppose, as well as a budding physicist, it was just the most incredible application of everything in science. Like hundreds of years of, human development, in science engineering, and there's this pilot, tumbling this aircraft around the sky using every possible physics principle you can imagine. You know, everything from like gyroscopics to thermodynamics, like it's all in there. And to me, that was just captivating. So I'm really not one to kind of hang around. If I have an idea in my head, like I'll just go do it. So I went and I took an intro flight in an Extra 300 over in England later that summer. And it was just a sort of a instructor does a loop, you try and do one. Instructor does a roll, you try and do one. But I absolutely loved it. Like there was something about it that just made me feel completely connected with the airplane and the sky. Like, and I've said this so many times, it's very hard to put it into words, because I aerobatics, like it just creates an emotional response in me that I don't think it's paralleled with, with anything else. For me, I think it always comes back to this idea of complete mastery of a machine.
Yes.
Like if you can throw an airplane around the sky like that with commitment and on purpose, with exact parameters for speed and height class and whatever else. Like there's such a sense of power and leadership in that. I just don't think there's anything more satisfying. So that first flight was completely formative to me. Like it was, I landed thinking, I can do this and I can do this really, really well. And I always think, God, what an embarrassing thought. Like, that's very not Irish to be like, I can do this really well, But
It's
that's what I
usually,
felt like.
sure, we'll give it a go, but you
Yeah,
know yourself.
exactly. But I was just blown away by it. And I was like, I absolutely know that I can do this stuff. Like, and that sense of kind of, seeing the road mapped out and how I would get to that level, like that's what I had. Like I could see it very clearly, and I knew exactly what I needed to do after that. Tail wheel rating, dual flying in one of these aircraft competitions, blah blah blah. And I suppose that's the other thing as well. Like from day one from that flight, I knew I wanted to do competition style. I personally adore competition stress. It's the most awful, wonderful feeling on earth to be in a competitive event with all that awful pressure, and the adrenaline and the nerves, and then the sort of exhilaration afterwards,
Yes.
when you've done a good flight. So I knew it was going to be that kind of style of flying from day one that I would go after.
It's amazing.
So that was day one, yeah. And I just obviously there was lots of things along the way that I had to do then to get myself. Even solo on an extra or similar, and so on, and obviously that's a whole number of years of the story. Like,
Yeah, a mate of mine has just bought a share in an extra. He's the same guy who taught me aerobatics, has flown aerobatics for ages, has an RVA, and he still gets in the extra and goes, there's lots of, he's still trying to get his head around it. And he said, there's lots of gotcha moments. It's like, oh, damn.
yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And when did you start doing your extra training then? When's that fairly early on?
I suppose so. That was my first flight in 2005, and I kind of mentioned this earlier in relation to the flying instructor kind of side of things, but we are a very small community. Like, you know, everyone in aviation knows each other, it seems, and certainly everyone in aerobatic aviation knows each other. So I very quickly learned who had two-seater airplanes in Ireland through some, you know, internet reconnaissance, because that's what you do then, you know, you go and suss out who. So I hassled them all, as you do, because like I said, I just don't like hanging around. If I have an idea in my head, I go after it. So I got in contact with Eddie Goggins and Dave Bruton, both of which had two-seater aircraft, and managed to convince them to take me up and teach me the fundamentals. And I did that over the course of just a few months with good weather in the coming year or two, you know, and they taught me all the basics. And like you said, actually, earlier, maybe even before we started recording the podcast, it's all about where to look and when. And learning that from day one kind of circumvented me ever feeling nauseous or disorientated. Actually, it's the key to aerobatics. Not only to make yourself not feel sick, but also to fly good aerobatics, you know, to make good shapes in the air. And I did my first ever competition in 2009 in England, and very quickly realized that England is absolutely incredible for this stuff. They take such pride in their aviation heritage anyway, but they really, really kind of encourage people to get into stuff like aerobatics, you know. And I found quite a lovely community of people there who love aerobatics, who love competing, training, and lots of aircraft to rent as well, which is great. So since 2009, I've been going more and more and more to the UK to just do all my flying there, which is certainly the current state of affairs now. So I just go to England every month to do some upside down flying.
It's brilliant to
And
see. I see it on your Instagram. Every second post is upside down. It's brilliant.
No, it's a great place, and everyone's so welcoming there, you know. And certainly for me, like I always kind of think back and I giggle. Like, I mean, I at one point I remember literally knocking on the door at Cambridge Aero Club, like this little Irish girl, kind of going, "Can I rent your extra?" Like, and no one laughed at me. I mean, maybe they did behind my back, but like, they were so welcoming. Like, and that's absolutely amazing. Like.
Well, it was like when I was speaking to you before about coming up and having a go in your guys' extra. The only extra I've ever really had a go in was Dave Bruton's, and I was nine. So that's how long it's been since I've had a go in an extra. And I got my aerobatics thing, and I was just really wanted to fly something that's a little bit different to the 152 aerobat, where I didn't have to dive to get to 125 knots and then pull. And if you don't hit 4G, you're not making it over the top. So it's really like. It's like going back to what you said, it's brilliant to see that people are offering these and being able to actually say, I've got an aerobatic rating. Can I hire your airplane? And nobody turns around and goes, good one.
Exactly. That's it. They just have a great attitude to it over there, you know.
I find like I love flying around Ireland and everything like that. And that's where I learned to fly and everything. But I find there's a bit of an elitism kind of we I cut my teeth on microlights and everything, and myself and my dad have both experienced people going, oh, you're going up in your kite. Whereas you get over here in the UK and it's completely different. A plane, if it has wings and flies, everything's respected, and
You're good to
that's
go, and
exactly
exactly,
it. And I think that's why if you can show that you can fly something, say like the extra or something like that, these people will help you and reach out and pull you up to and that's why I think you didn't get
definitely.
after.
And I know, sure, look, it's in every country and in every, you know, pursuit, there's always going to be people who kind of laugh at you and whatever. I think the trick is just to filter them out.
It says a lot about them more than the other person, doesn't it?
For sure.
Let's touch on the aerobatic training side of it, because we were speaking a bit off air on this, I think, as well. There's a lot more to it than people think. Like you said, you go to the air shows, you see Eddie Goggins or Dave Bruton hooning it around the sky and stuff. But there's a lot of, I think you can nearly say biology more than anything in it.
For
And this is
sure.
what I loved about the ground school and my aerobatics course. is G tolerance. Let's talk about the G tolerance and how you deal with it, because you pull some mad stuff. I've seen you touch, was it -4 plus 8?
Yeah, well, definitely +8. And then depending on what I'm, well, depending on the figure I'm doing, it could be -2, 3, 4, 5, 6 ++. Of course, the G meter just stops beyond 5, I think, -5. So you never know. That's like no man's land down there in the negative. But anyway, yeah.
So what do you think you've pushed?
I'd have a fairly good idea that sometimes it's been a -7, you know?
No way.
But it's, don't laugh now, but you know, the quicker you push, the quicker it's over. It's like ripping the plaster off, you know? Yeah, so it's actually more uncomfortable to do like a -3G loop than it is to just push for a second at -7, 8, 9 and get it done.
Jeez. That's a lot though, isn't it? What does that even feel? I couldn't even fathom. What's it feel like?
So this is actually great. I you know, it's wonderful to do this podcast because I know I'm talking to flyers, so I can have at it with the details. But sometimes it feels like your eyes are going to explode and your brain has started to bleed. But it's over very quickly, so yeah.
So you wouldn't be pushing -8 for long at all?
No, you wouldn't. In general, you wouldn't. Not at advanced level aeros anyway. It's over pretty quick. And anytime you need to do something like that, it's usually pushing, let's say, from level inverted to vertical up. So it's a little radius, just a little radius. Yeah.
Wow. And there's nothing you can do for a negative, is it? Because with positive, you know, we're taught clench your butt cheeks, clench your stomach, and try and keep the blood in the head. But for a negative, I don't think there's anything you can really do, is there?
No, there's a few tricks. So when I started doing the heavier negative pushes, I was trying to do stuff actually to combat it. And I was doing all the wrong things. So the latest wisdom I have after this last year is to completely relax and try, if you can, to tilt your head forward a little bit.
Okay.
And it does help. It really does help. I think where it becomes challenging is if you have a sequence where you've pulled quite a lot of positive G.
Yep.
For which you've been, as you said, clenching your core and breathing and bracing yourself. And then you rapidly have to push some negative G and then go back to positive G again, because you're going from fully clenched to fully relaxed. And actually, the mechanism to do that, you know, it's very hard to actually be able to switch that on and off. So you're going from a fully tense human being to completely relaxing yourself and then back again, you know. So, it's quite the workout.
If you can imagine
an unforgiving sequence like that. Okay, someone goes up and does a 12-minute air show routine and is probably panting hard after it, you know. It's quite the workout, but yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, there could be as much sort of on the ground prep for that as you like. I personally weightlift, and I have done for a number of years, and that helps quite a bit with your core bracing techniques. So for example, if you read up on any of the correct techniques for like deadlifting, that ability to brace your core and breathe correctly is exactly what you need to be able to do for aerobatics, for positive G.
Brilliant. So it's kind of like you said, training yourself on the ground for that.
Totally.
But doing exactly that, is to say.
It's the same thing. Yeah. Same muscles. Yeah.
Wow. And does that help with your G tolerance at all as well? Because for some people who might not have done aerobatics listening to this, the blood gets pushed away from your head. If you don't try and keep it in your head, you're going to go to grey vision, tunnel vision, and blackout, and called G-lock.
Exactly, yeah. And absolutely it does. And the more you can switch on and off that bracing technique, you know, the better you're going to be able to cope with the G-forces. Yeah. And in general, anyway, that, like, if you're doing weightlifting or anything like that, you're going to have a healthier composition regardless, which always puts you in better stead for something like aerobatics, you know, which is quite, it can be quite physically demanding as you go up the levels.
Yeah. I've heard a couple of rumors as well that there was a rumor going around that the RAF as well at the time didn't want you too fit because it the little bit of cholesterol will actually stop the blood rushing away. I don't know if you guys have heard that in your side of the instructor side, or if there's any nonsense to it, or
I've definitely heard that, but you know, there's lots of I would say there's quite a lot of bar talk in flying in general and in aviation. Like the last thing I heard actually was one of the last nuggets of information I heard was that women are better at G tolerance.
I've heard this as well, and short people. Yeah.
Yes, so I'm female and short, so I apparently can do G very well. But that being said, like, and we mentioned this just before recording as well, this year I really had a newfound appreciation for G tolerance changing on a daily basis. So certainly in the run up to the championships, I found that my G tolerance at the beginning of the training week was insane. Like I was able to do plus minus something off the scale. And then towards the end of the week, because I was getting quite tired, it was coming down and down and down, little by little. And it's directly influenced by, of course, how well rested you are. Are you well hydrated and fed and so on and so on. So yeah, it's a very interesting topic.
So what would your kind of, if you want to stay tip top, you've got a week of flying, aerobatics and stuff. What would your kind of daily routine look like to stop you from getting fatigued and your G tolerance coming down day by day?
So ideally, if I employed my absolute best self-discipline and tried not to fly every second of the day, I would ideally do one training flight a day for maybe 3 or 4 days, something like that. However, it's very person dependent. I know some guys don't want to fly at all in the run up to a competition, maybe just one flight,
yeah,
and that's it. And then I know others who will fly twice a day every day for a week.
Wow.
And it's a psychological thing as well. I suppose it's like, you know, how well prepped do I feel mentally for this competition? And if that means flying every single day twice a day for a week, then that's your thing. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me certainly a flight a day for maybe 3, 4, 5 days is more than enough, and obviously very well rested, good sleeps, and that's when I really need to employ my food monster as well. I need to eat a lot, so yeah. But thankfully, I love food, so
yeah, <It's> yeah. <all good. laughs> When I see your Instagram and you're out in competitions, it's flying food, flying food.
it's a great combination.
Because back to, like I said earlier, the 100-pound hamburger.
Oh, yeah. And I'm so thankful I don't get sick. Like, I never feel sick from aerobatics. So I can eat, like, as soon as I land. I'm ready.
And then go again straight after.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, because you recently went to Vegas to compete in the World Aerobatic Championships, which is awesome. Give us a rundown on what that was like. And who, because I know you rented an extra. Who did you convince to let you have their extra?
Oh, my God. Okay, we'll start with the rental extra question. Yeah, so thankfully there was a couple of guys renting out their two-seaters for competitors. Because in America, getting hold of something like that for a competition is challenging, as you might imagine. There was an awful lot of competitors that were hoping to rent single seaters, and that became a bit of an issue. And I suspect that if it was not an issue, there would have been a lot more competitors at the competition. However, that's a whole other story. So it was myself and four other guys renting an extra 330 LX from a lovely guy altogether. But it's actually a school airplane.
Oh, wow.
And they ferried it over to the competition for the 2.5 weeks, which is great. Now, of course, we paid healthily for it, of course, as you might imagine. But, you know, and there was lots of paperwork and contracts to sign in the meantime, and liabilities and so on, and renter's insurance, which was a whole new thing to me for renting in America. So, yes, I had secured that rental extra well in advance of actually arriving in Las Vegas for the competition. So the format was, there was a training week prior to the competition. So I ended up flying out of Shannon on the 18th of October, Shannon, JFK, and then to Las Vegas. And I had 5 days of training before the championships officially opened. And in reference to my self-discipline and training flights before I actually end up flying twice a day every day.
Wow.
And it was a lot.
Was that more for training, or was that more for the excitement of I'm in a different country about to do a competition, I just really want to fly?
There was definitely a bit of excitement because, I mean, goodness, like, there always is, you know. I'd like to fly every day upside down, but anyway. But definitely to get used to the place, it was invaluable. It was a very strange airfield for me because I've never flown in such high density altitudes before.
Yes.
The elevation of the airport was like 2,800 feet.
Wow.
And for the training week, the temperatures were all 30 degrees Celsius plus. Like,
so you were hot and high.
Very. And it was noticeable. And it was very interesting because I had done some kind of mental maths beforehand and kind of graphed out like what kind of horsepower I could, you know, achieve with the engine and so on. And just so I had some idea, and I had some ideas about maybe trying to simulate the different roll rate in the thinner air and so on, which would be significant. But I remember landing after one of the flights during the training week and thinking, it feels like flying in soup. Like there was like no bite to the air. So even when you moved the prop to full fine and went full power, like the prop wasn't biting the air as it normally would in normal elevations and temperatures, you know. So yeah, it was very strange. And the other thing as well is the landscape around there, it was very mountainous and it was very hard to find the real horizon. So I found myself very often leveling out upside down with too high a nose attitude because I was referencing off the mountain range, which was much higher than the actual real horizon. So just, yeah, lots of illusions to take care of, and just different performance considerations. And I thought I would have, during the competition, an advantage with power just because I'm quite light and the airplane is just so powerful compared to most people, you know.
Yeah.
And I did find in some of my competition flights that I was gaining altitude where others were not. So the performance or the lack of performance due to the high density altitude didn't inhibit me in any way. Actually, I probably had, you know, 50 horsepower too much still.
So, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And then because you did a lot, was it Hungary you do a lot of training courses and competitions in?
Yeah. So I managed last year to get a coach, an aerobatic coach. You really do need a coach at this level. It becomes kind of difficult to progress to advanced and unlimited without somebody on the ground coaching you. And he is based in Hungary. So I did a training camp with him actually in the week prior to the Las Vegas competition, which was great.
Brilliant. And the two places, I take it, were just stark contrast from each other, but based, like you say, with aircraft handling and everything.
Oh, yeah. Chalk and cheese. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Because it's not something that, like the likes of myself, who's not into competition aeros and stuff, it's not something we'd really be thinking about. It's something you think about if you went in a normal flight, but we're doing competitions and stuff, you wouldn't think, oh, I'm going to level out a little bit nose high here or anything like that. So
It was just lots of differences to take account of, you know, and you're already quite full to capacity anyway with, you know, the aerobatics. So the other operational stuff you need to start considering. Yeah. Yeah. So it was really interesting. Yeah.
Wow. And how did you finish up in that competition?
Oh, terribly, like as expected. I mean, I really, really wanted to go there and just participate. The only thing I had in my head was just don't come last. And I didn't, which was great. But last year was very much kind of throwing myself in the deep end. Like I really wanted to just do a load of competitions, get that competition pressure exposure, and then worry about training this year. So I think I came, I don't know, like 40 something. I don't even know in the end. But just, I suppose, on a personal level, my first two competition flights, I was really chuffed with. Like, they went really, really well. And I was actually really happy with the scores. The last one was a bit of a disaster. I was so tired. It was a strange one because I ended up flying really early in the competition. I drew, like, a running order number of very low, which meant I flew on, like, the first day. And then because what they do is they permute the groups of pilots to fly in order to not have anyone fly twice in one day.
Okay.
I ended up flying, well, in theory, I was supposed to fly 3 days later my next flight. It turned into 6 days because of wind. The wind went out on limits at the competition airfield. Now, I mean, we would fly normally in normal circumstances, but they have very particular wind limits at altitude for the international competitions. So we were all grounded for 6 days, and I had just been flying twice a day, every day for a week. So I went from full G tolerance to nothing much at all.
Wow.
And that was really tough, not flying for 6 days after.
Was it a nice kind of recuperating, or was it just not nice at all? It was just tough.
So for maybe three of those days, it was okay. I was like, great. I'm enjoying this break. And it was a lot of time to mentally prepare for the next flight. And I was very well prepared for that next flight, and it went really, really well. But I found that after I landed from that second flight, after the 6 day wait and the amped up, you know, anxiety from waiting to fly, I was shattered. Then all the tiredness struck me, and I ended up flying 2 days later, and I was just so tired. Like,
wow.
So, yeah, it was very, that's when I noticed, oh, I really have no G tolerance now at all. So, yeah, it's interesting. I suppose it's like any kind of sport like that. Like, I suppose, you know, if you go to the Olympics and you do gymnastics, your performance lasts for, what, 4 minutes?
Yeah.
And then you have a long wait period before the next performance. So it's all about managing your energy appropriately. And I feel like going forward, like, I'll have my eyes much wider open to that phenomenon of a championships now in future.
Yeah, because it's you are like a, let's say, a top athlete. You don't get any higher competitions than this. You're at the peak of the game. And I do imagine it takes a lot out of you, especially when you said you get to the end of that kind of 6 days and you're absolutely zonked out. And it's nice to kind of, if you just did everything at the start of the week and was like, right, that's it, done, dusted.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It definitely makes more sense now.
But and unfortunately, the rules are not like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Have you plans to do any more of them and do more world championships and stuff?
Oh, goodness. Yes. Yeah. I haven't stopped competing since that first one in 2009. So I'll just continue on. My plan this year is to do the UK Nationals there in July in Sewell.
Oh, I saw that advertised. I might pop up to them, actually. I had a plan
please
to do
that. Yeah. Do you know what? It's going to be amazing and a great venue as well. And then the European Championships are in Romania in September, so I'm definitely doing them. They're representing
Brilliant.
Ireland again, so it'll be great. Yeah.
That's awesome. Not many people can say they represented their country in something they're so passionate about and a sport they're so passionate about. So I really take my hat off to you for that one. That's absolutely brilliant. Because you actually come slightly back a bit. Wasn't there like an opening ceremony as well at the World Aerobatic Championships where you got to go and wave the Irish flag and stuff around the Nevada desert?
Yeah. There was, and I was actually quite embarrassed because I was like, who's holding my flag? Like, who gets to hold the Irish flag? And then someone said, pick up your flag. And I was like, what? So yeah, I got to be my own flag bearer, like Team Ireland. Yeah, it was great and weird and surreal, but really awesome, like. Yeah.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Hopefully long may that continue. Because you're breaking ground for people, and especially women in aviation as well, because you're the first to go and do it. And it's great for Irish people to see that someone's going to do this. And I know Nora from down your direction as well, she's set to be the first Irish person in space. So it's great to have both of you guys doing this and breaking down walls and barriers and showing people that this is possible and this is what we can do.
Totally, I agree. And you know what? I just think there's so much value in just going and doing this stuff. You know, you could be talking about it forever. And I know, like, we're all guilty of that. You know, we might all have kind of hopes and dreams and bucket lists. But if you just go and do one of those things, like, it's just very empowering. And it's great when, you know what, I get loads of people, like, young and old, saying to me, fair play to you, like, that's amazing. That's great. That, for me, is the biggest reward. You know, showing people you can just go and do whatever you want to do if you love it, like, you know?
Yeah. And the one thing about that as well is COVID showed me something. It was, life is too short. And if you've stuff, there's no point rolling it down the road. Just go and grab life by both hands and enjoy it and have crack with it.
That's it. Exactly. Yeah.
And that's another thing, again, I take my hat off to you doing, because you were like, oh, I love flying upside down. I'm just going to do it. I'm going to go and make it happen. I'm going to go to the UK or wherever I need to go and make this happen. And you've done it, and now look at the level that you're performing at, which is amazing.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, you know what? I always say to people, you know, I'm not brilliant in aerobatics. I'm probably pretty crap at it, actually, but I don't care, but because I love it, you know? So I will keep doing it.
I love that. I absolutely love that attitude towards it. It's brilliant. We've spoken about a couple of your characteristics and stuff like that. We're like physicists, stuff like that. You've got all the makings here of possible astronaut as well. We're talking about Nora and stuff. Is that something that's been on your scope or something that you're interested in to go and do?
I actually investigated the offering when was it the ESA opened this a couple of years ago.
Oh,
There
yeah.
was like a, I don't know, I call it the astronaut cadetship, and
I love that.
yeah, I guess it is like yeah, cadetship for astronauts. I actually wasn't too bothered, to be honest. I don't know what it is. I think for me. Like, how would I put it into words? For me, the skill of flying an airplane is a very unique, personal, satisfying thing, and I don't think anything could ever come close to replace that. When I looked at the job application for this astronaut cadetship thing, and what you'd be doing on a day-to-day basis, it just seemed to me, anyway, that there was not enough action. You know, yeah. Not to take anything away from the job, I mean it's absolutely phenomenal, but the appeal of something like that is just not as great at all as flying upside down, teaching people to fly upside down, you know.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. It's like you can look at someone else who thinks a job's absolutely amazing, and again, everyone's got their own thing of how to look at something and is it for them, is it not for them. And no, I like that, the way that most people, you ask them in school, I want to be an astronaut, and I like the fact that you can look at something like that and be like, do you know what? That's not a bit of me. That's really, really good.
I think it's the same. Like, when I was in school, like I hadn't a notion what to do, and I mean, goodness, you're not supposed to when you're in school, really. Even though you might feel the pressure to choose something to study for the rest of your life, like that's absolutely not the case. And I remember after my PhD, I was so sick of research. I really felt that if I had seen the inside of another research lab, I would just go mad. Like, so I very much wanted out of that kind of academic lifestyle. And that's why I applied for, you know, what I considered regular jobs. So I got into that engineering company in Galway, Valeo, who, do you know what, they're brilliant. Like, and I made some unreal friends there. But I very quickly realized, and without this job, I wouldn't have realized, I hated open plan offices, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. It was just awful. And I remember thinking, every week, people are counting down to it being Friday, and I couldn't understand it. Why are you obsessed with it becoming Friday? This happens every week. And it used to drive me mad. So it became very clear to me then. I think that's when I really made the decision to go after the commercial flying, because I knew I would never have a Monday to Friday then, you know. I would have something different every single day, every single week, you know. And that was a great bonus to me. Yeah, I knew I did not want to be in a 9 to 5 job.
And I take it you don't get that counting down to Friday with Lingus and with your instructional jobs at all.
Not at all, because I never know what day it is. It's great.
The joys of working in commercial aviation, I have that as well. I bumped into a friend of mine yesterday and I said, I'm back in I said, when are you back in? He went, Sunday. I said, what day is it today? And then his mate went, you guys shift workers then.
Yes, I think we all suffer from it. Anyone in aviation, ground or in the air, we haven't a notion what day it is. Maybe not even what month it is.
No, it's like, especially now with the change, I'm still writing 2023 on most of the reports I do. It's like, oh,
Oh,
okay.
yeah. The tech log is already full of my scrolls from the last few days, 23, May 24. Yeah.
It's gonna take a while. So I laugh because it's take me a while. It'd be March now before I get my head around it, and then next thing I know, we're changing over to 25.
Yes.
Laura, what advice would you give to any young person trying to get into this, or even not, any person who, like you said, they are now stuck in what they call the rat race. They've come out of school, they've thought about, oh, I need to get a real job, as to say. and they want to change that. Because I think, going back a little bit back to what we were saying, I think it's madness being told at the age of 16, 17 to decide what you want to do for the rest of your life. So what advice would you have for people who have now gone down a course and thought, no, I want to get into aviation and do like the Aer Lingus cadetship or some of them other cadetships that you see coming up?
Yeah, so definitely a couple of things that I would strongly recommend. First of all, no matter what, if you have an interest in aviation and an interest potentially in flying, get the application in for the Aer Lingus Cadetship, or the Future Pilot Program, as they call it nowadays. I always liken it to buying a lottery ticket. If you're not in, you can't win, and keep it as your plan A. And in the meantime, work away on your plan B, C, D, whatever. If you do know you like flying anyway, take an intro flight. Even if the airport is miles away from you and hard to get to, it's so important, I think, to do that, to get a sneak preview of what a training flight is like. You know, you may not enjoy it, or it may just confirm that you absolutely love it. So that's very specific advice, I guess, if anyone knows that they want to maybe go into flying. And the other thing I'd say in general is, don't be afraid to change your mind and try things in order to eliminate them from your choices. Like, definitely, even when I was in fourth year in school, like I did work experience in like a biology lab, and I knew kind of then that I liked science stuff, but it turns out I really didn't enjoy the biology lab stuff. It was really boring. I found it kind of, yeah, whatever. And if I hadn't done that, I would have actually put down biochem as number one in my CAO, you know, so that would have been very ill-advised, you know. Don't be afraid to kind of to eliminate things by trying them out. Like, you can change career when you're 60, 70, 80, like, you know, these days. You know, you really can. Like, there's nothing stopping you from pursuing whatever you want at whatever age you want, you know. Don't think that you need to make a decision right now. The other thing as well is, if anyone needs specific flying career information, the internet is so wonderful. Like, message me on Instagram, or Mikey, or whoever, anyone you find, like anyone who's involved in aviation. I'm pretty sure we're all very happy to talk endlessly about flying and aviation. So I think it's no harm at all to reach out to people if you want some expertise or guidance or opinions. No problem to reply. I certainly would be happy to talk to anyone about any of this stuff in more detail if they have questions, you know.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant, Laura. And the final thing we'll go on to today is, you've done so much in your, say, short career that you've done and with aerobatics. Have you got plans for this year or for the future? What's that looking like for you?
My grand plan has always been the same since I started flying aerobatics. I want to get to unlimited, which is the top level of aerobatics. I think you have to be a little bit crazy to go that far, because it's quite a step up from advanced. But that's my goal, and I'm working away, chipping towards it each year. So this year I'm going to do a lot more training. Last year, as I mentioned, it was all about kind of competitions and throw myself in at the deep end up against competitors who are absolutely incredible, like, and have been competing for years. So lots of training camps this year. The UK Nationals in July, and the European Championships in Romania in September. And I'm hoping then next winter to start making some inroads towards unlimited level flying with my coach. So that's the vague outline. It's going to be a slow process, I think, because I think when you move up the levels in aerobatics, the jumps between the levels become quite nonlinear. So the jump between intermediate and advanced is one thing, but the jump from advanced to to unlimited is quite sizable. So it'll take a good few years to get all the fundamentals right and make a comfortable jump. I'll probably never own my own extra 330, but I will keep buying the lottery tickets.
If you're not in, you can't win.
Yeah, exactly. Keep dreaming about it. And that's the aerobatic plans anyway. And at work, I'm happy out. Like, I'm very lucky. I'm based in Cork, and it's great there, you know.
Yeah.
You have lovely rosters and lovely people. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Laura, thank you so much for your time today. And I really appreciate you coming on and telling us your story. It's been absolutely amazing.
Not at all. Thanks a million.
No worries. Have a great one.